Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. A hacking group says it has infiltrated the NSA and is now auctioning off its cyber weapons, the weapons used by the agency itself. Who's behind it, and what does the news tell us about the way the NSA work? Former President Bill Clinton turned 70 today, but what's his actual legacy? War against Yugoslavia? The end of welfare at home? Millions of jobs sent overseas? Prisons overflowing in record numbers with impoverished young people? The destruction of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Joe Biden went to Serbia this week, where he was greeted by crowds of protesters. Now activists will erect a monument to the victims of NATO's bombing of Novi Sad in 1999. We will look at the Yugoslav War and what happened next. But first, we turn to the alleged hack of the NSA. We are joined by William Binney. Bill Binney, a former NSA intelligence official who became a prominent whistleblower after September 11th, 2001. Welcome back, Bill Binney.
Well, thank you. That's good to be back.
Tell us about the alleged hack. Who claims to be behind it? What do they say they have? And according to what have they been able to see? Is it legitimate?
Well, it certainly seems to be legitimate. That's almost 300 megs worth of software and things like that. So and I think it's source code also. I haven't seen it myself, but I believe that's what it is. I would lean more to another Snowden-type person internally, compromising this by taking it out, rather than have somebody hack in. The NSA network is supposed to be closed. And for the most part, I think it probably is, although this does raise questions. I mean, there are only basically two options. One, there's an insider who is basically taking the material out and compromised it. Or two, network is not really totally closed, and there's an access point that goes out to the outer web so that people could access that network. Otherwise, it's a closed ring.
Well, for the lay audience, for our broad public, explain what was hacked. I mean, what is this? Why is it significant? Just talk about the basics in a way that the broader audience can understand.
Well, I think it's the software or the logic that they use and the techniques that they use to be able to hack into devices and break through firewalls and penetrate through different networks and servers and firewalls and what have you around the world, so they can hack into people and take their material. So I think it's the software that they're using to do that, or have used to do that.
So it's actually revealing what the offensive capabilities are of the NSA to hack themselves.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's the stuff they've been using around the world. But see, part of the problem, though, is when you do these kinds of hacks, you risk losing that software once you put it out there to execute the hack, because then people can capture it, look at it, and review it and see how it operates, and then perhaps modify it and then turn it back on you. It's like the Stuxnet virus that was placed in the Iranian nuclear facilities. That virus, they have copies of it now, and they're looking at it. I'm sure that virus can now come right back at us. So that's the hazard of doing these kinds of things. If you put it out there and they capture it, they can modify it, adjust it, and turn it back on you. So this is a never-ending fight, I think, the cyber war.
I want to stay with this a little bit. The group that hacked the NSA, that they call themselves the Shadow Brokers. They're the ones who are releasing piece by piece, not all at once, that which they've hacked. I want to talk to you about some of the terms, and again, to help the audience understand what it is precisely that's been hacked. The Shadow Brokers Group claims to have acquired NSA exploits from the hack. What is an exploit, and why is that important?
Well, I think what they're talking about is the software and the the code that's used to attack people. That's the exploit. Take their data out and exploit it, exfiltrate the data out of the different computers, servers, and switches, and so on. I think they're talking about the software that allows them to attack devices and pull that information out.
And then, again, just a matter of definition, so for our broader audience, also stolen were what's called implants. What information can these be used to acquire?
Okay, but an implant is like some of the things that they'll have in implants is they will put the software in a switch in the network. So what that means is that software can see what's passing through the switch and whatever instructions you give it to forward data, it will take the data going through the switch and duplicate it to you. So it's like you have remote control of that switch and you can do anything with the data passing through it.
Okay, and then the third category, the hack was particularly effective because it took advantage of a zero-day bug that had been present in the NSA toolkit since it was created. What is a zero-day bug, and why was this one particularly difficult to find?
Well, I think it's built into the software right at the beginning, and it's like a backdoor kind of thing that's placed in there. It's the bug in the devices right from the very beginning, or it's the weakness in software that has never been fixed. And this is one of the problems I had with what they're doing. I mean, once they find a weakness in a system, they should, in fact, fix it, at least for us. You know, they should fix it. But the offensive side of NSA doesn't like to fix problems because if they get fixed, that window closes and they can't see through them. So it stops them from being able to exploit that weakness in the system. So they have a tendency not to fix things, which means we poor people out here sitting around in the real, and including OPM and various other organizations, have software that's got weaknesses in it. And if we don't fix it, that means they're open and exposed and can be attacked, hacked, and drained, which like OPM was. So it's a kind of a double-edged sword. One, you want to use it for offense, but two, you need to protect yourself against it. But if you do, then the cat's out of the bag, and you lose that capability to have the offense. So it's kind of a double-edged sword effect.
Does the NSA acquire the information, say, with the zero-day bug or with other tools, whereby they understand what the vulnerabilities are in a particular a firewall, a tool or a system designed to protect a website, protect an information system? They acquire the knowledge about what the vulnerability is, and then they don't notify, say, a company or a government agency or whoever has the vulnerability. They keep that vulnerability, the knowledge of that vulnerability to themselves, because that allows them to come into that entity if they so choose at a particular time. And thus, instead of fixing the problem, they keep the information, allow the vulnerability to continue either for their own use or it could be sort of unintentionally used by other hackers. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And in fact, in some cases, the companies help them build those weaknesses in. But I've maintained all along that the NSA has no monopoly on smart people. There are countries around the world and other organizations, intelligence organizations, who have equally smart people, and they can look at this software that's built into this hardware devices that's stored in there and used to operate the device. They can look in there and find these weaknesses too. So that means that they also can take advantage of these kinds of backdoors and weaknesses in systems.
We're talking to William Binney. Bill Binney is a prominent whistleblower after 9/11. Before Edward Snowden, there was William Binney. And of course, Edward Snowden cites the example of Bill Binney, what he did, his role as a whistleblower, the price he paid for it, as part of his own inspiration and also part of the reason that he took a particular path in terms of how to proceed with whistleblowing about the NSA. Bill Binney, let me ask you about the equation group. Was it the equation group or the NSA itself that was hacked? And what is the equation group?
I haven't worked at NSA since all of this digital attacking started and all of this network exploitation came into being. That started after 9/11, which is when I retired out of NSA in October of 2001. So all these new organizations are kind of new to me too. So I pretty much know only what's been written about them in the media. Other than that, I have a basic idea on how the technology works, and that's kind of the insight that I get from.
Even if you don't have direct information, can you talk about what the Equation Group is? I mean, even based on what you're reading in the media.
I just think that's just I think that's probably just an attack type set of programmers who devise and develop these attacks and develop the software to do it. I think that's what it is.
Okay. And let me ask you this. In social media posts, the hacking group, they call themselves, again, the Shadow Brokers. They're saying that they're going to release more information in an auction offer for Bitcoins. We auction the best files to the highest bidder, auction files better than Stuxnet. What is that all about? Is that real or is that a distraction?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like somebody's trying to profit from material that was taken out, I believe, by some insider. It's more likely that that's the case than being penetrated because, their network is supposed to be closed so that there are no access points coming in from the outside networks, so that they can't be drained of information. That's why they have it closed and so on. And it's also, by the way, it's also under an encryption. So if they come into the network, I mean, they have to, there's so many things they have to go through to get to it. I mean, I would say that the point is that it's probably an insider that took the data out or gave it to them, and that they are trying to profit from it. I think that's what this all sounds like to me.
So what about the hack of the Democratic Party, which, of course, was big news? The Democratic National Committee, that hack proved that the Democratic Party establishment had been working really to undermine the Bernie Sanders campaign, something the Sanders campaign had been insisting upon as a reality. The chairperson of the Democratic National Committee on the first day of the convention was forced to resign, Deborah Wasserman Schultz, because it showed that she was illegally, according to the Democratic Party rules, using her position and the position of the executives to tilt the election towards the direction of Hillary Clinton. Now, the DNC tried to change the subject and say, well, we are the victims of Russia, and that the Russian government, you know, is trying to tilt the election in the direction of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is sort of the Manchurian candidate of Vladimir Putin. I mean, that was sort of the whole politics of distraction. But Snowden, in his comments about this recent hack, thought the recent release of what would be an explanation or an expose of NSA's offensive weapons might have been done by the Russians or a Russian-related hacking operation as retaliation for that. What do you think about that theory?
Well, you see, I'm still kind of stuck on the concept of closed networks and protected networks in the way of being physically isolated, and that's basically what the NSA network is. So if they're talking about going into that network, it's more likely that that information was taken out of NSA by some insider. At least the probabilities are leaning in that direction rather than having someone hack into a supposedly closed network. I mean, if that network is not closed, then the implications are much, much greater in terms of a compromise of information and data than simply this draining of their exploitation software.
One of the issues that this hack raises is what the NSA's real objectives are, because it's charged with national security or cybersecurity. But I want to quote to you from former NSA official, former employee who worked at the agency's what's called Tailored Access Organization for years. And this is what he's quoted in the Washington Post. I can't think of a single example with a zero-day flaw where the NSA essentially told the companies or the agencies or the organizations that there was a particular flaw. Again, because whatever the NSA has, they want to be able to potentially use at some other time for offensive operations, offensive intelligence gathering. In other words, to go through that flaw to use it as a backdoor. Then why should the National Security Agency be described as a security agency when it's clearly not about the security of the agencies it's supposed to be protecting or about American companies. It really is, in many ways, just an offensive operation because it is always at war.
Yeah, that was what I was talking about earlier, about them not fixing problems, and that, you know, they are not the only people who have smart people working for them. They have other organizations around the world, intelligence organizations, you know, of other countries that also have smart people who are looking at this information and this data and these programs and firewalls and so on, so that they can find the same weaknesses. And they'll exploit them, too. So if you don't fix them, you're leaving everybody open to an attack. That's my point. And that's what happened with OPM, for example, with all the hacks you've heard about that are being written about here are because of flaws in the software or weaknesses or holes that allow people in.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with William Binney. Bill Binney was a prominent whistleblower, a former NSA intelligence official who left the agency after September 11, 2001. We're talking about the most recent hack of the NSA. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined by Kevin Aiken, the state chairperson of the California State Peace and Freedom Party, and by Jane Cutter from Seattle, Washington. She's the editor of liberationnews.org website. We're talking about Bill Clinton on his birthday. He turned 70 years old today. Looking back at Bill Clinton's 8 years in office from 1993 to 2001, Kevin Aiken, how would you sum up those two terms? What do you remember about the Clinton years?
Oh, my. I remember a lot. My first and overwhelming impression is that Bill Clinton managed to take the Democratic Party far enough to the right that they put many of the right-wing Republicans' programs into practice, both the greatly increasing the size of the prisons and the number of people sent to them, and greatly increasing as well some of the programs like chopping welfare, reducing support for people without jobs.
Okay, Kevin, let me ask you that, because I want to just jump in. When I was here in Washington, D.C., when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 and he took office in January 1981, by May 3rd, 1981, we had 100,000 people in the streets demonstrating against the war policies of the Reagan administration in Central America and El Salvador, but also because we knew welfare was on the chopping block. So we had unions, we had community groups, we had lots of young people, 100,000 people right after Reagan came in. He couldn't get rid of welfare, but then when Bill Clinton got rid of welfare as we know it, aid for dependent children, AFDC, 7 million kids cut off welfare in one fell swoop, there were hardly any protests. It really was Clinton and the Democrats doing what Ronald Reagan tried to do but were prevented from doing because of mass movements.
It was really a simple matter of the Democrats wanted power. The Democrats believed that in order to obtain power, they needed to move to the right. And the right-wing moves of the new Democratic president were accepted by Democrats because they believed that it was going to help their party retain power. And the morals of it, that was another matter entirely.
Jane Cutter, why was it necessary for the Democrats, who had a traditional base within working class, amongst the poor, certainly within the black community, with civil rights constituencies, why did the Democrats have to move, quote, to the right in order to have political power in the United States? I mean, those were the programs that Clinton attacked that were in direct opposition to the constituent base of the Democratic Party.
Well, you have to look at who the Democratic Party and politicians like Bill Clinton really represent. They don't actually represent the vast majority of the people who consider themselves Democrats. They don't represent those interests. Just like the Republican Party, they represent the class interests of the capitalist class in this country. And so the policies that had traditionally been considered democratic policies, traditionally liberal policies that had their origins in being associated with the Democratic Party, really in the era of the New Deal, clearly the capitalist class in this country were tired of supporting those programs, tired of shelling out additional funds, tired of not having as much control as they would like. And so it was time to appease them. And in order for the Democratic Party to get that control, they have to appease the ruling class, essentially give them what they want. And so that's what Bill Clinton did in his presidency, is he gave them what they wanted, but under cover of being a Democrat, under cover of being some kind of a liberal in people's minds anyways. So they were able to kind of sneak it in, put a little tiny bit of sugar around the bitter pill, hoping that people would swallow it.
Well, let's talk about what the bitter pill or pills were, Kevin Aiken. You have the issue of trade, NAFTA. You have the, which cost millions of jobs. You have mass incarceration, the elimination of welfare, as I mentioned. But there was also the elimination of prisoners' rights, the elimination of habeas corpus rights for death row prisoners. And there was the Yugoslav War and the decision by the U.S. government under Clinton to make regime change rather than weapons control, the issue in Iraq, which really politically set the stage for the Iraq War. Talk about some of those items, if you would.
Well, there was really a continuing war against Iraq. There were acts of war against Iraq that took place almost every day for the entire Clinton presidency, taking over the mantle from Bush. It ebbed and flowed, but Clinton continued the pressure meaning killings, sometimes mass killings in Iraq, just went on all the way through his presidency. The actual invasion waited for Bush the second, but Clinton laid the groundwork. I think that one aspect of Clinton's presidency that you have to consider is in the run-up during the campaign, he actually told us what he was going to do. Democrats hoped he was lying, rank-and-file Democrats, hoped that this was just a set of campaign promises that he wouldn't keep. Republicans didn't believe him, but he kept his campaign promises. One example from his campaign, there was a mentally disabled man in Arkansas who was set to be executed. The question of his mental disability was brought up. Clinton was completely impervious to this. He would not commute his sentence. In fact, he made a special flight home to Arkansas to sign the death warrant. And then he boasted to his inner circle that they can't call him soft on crime now. So here's this man killed in order to present a more right-wing, a more tough-on-crime image for Bill Clinton. And he carried through that all the way through his presidency.
Yeah, that was Kevin Aiken. He's the state chairperson of the Peace and Freedom Party. You're talking about Ricky Ray Rector. So just, it's an amazing story, actually. This man who is on death row, mentally disabled, severely disabled, who Clinton actually canceled campaign stops to be able to fly home and sign the death warrant so that he could be executed in 1992 as a sign that the Democrats were going to be, quote, tough on crime, so they could execute this mentally disabled individual purely for symbolic purposes. And the symbolism was to show that the Democrats were moving in the direction or adopting all of the slogans of the Republicans, including Reagan. Jane Cutter had demonized women on welfare, moms on welfare, as welfare queens, as if people were living in the lap of luxury at the public expense. I want to go back for a moment to Iraq, because Kevin talked about that. In 1998, Clinton passed something called the Iraq Liberation Act. He signed it into law. It was passed by the House and the Senate. And the bill says, and it became the law of the land, it should be the policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power. Now, he signed that into law. I was in Iraq in December 1998, just about a month after that bill was signed. And the Clinton administration started the signing of the bombing of Iraq in something called Operation Desert Fox. They dropped 1,000 bombs and missiles. We had to leave. Our delegation had to leave Iraq and pass through the desert. We couldn't fly out because there was a no-fly zone to Amman, Jordan. But the bombs were falling. And after that, Iraq was bombed every day by the Clinton administration. And then you have the issue of economic sanctions also imposed by Clinton on the people of Iraq. And according to the UN, Jane, 1 million Iraqis perished because of economic sanctions. I know you were part of the campaign to lift the economic sanctions, and you said, along with other activists, this was a form of genocide committed by the Clinton administration against Iraqi people, mainly kids.
That's absolutely correct. When there was sort of an upsurge in activism in 1998 when it became clear that Clinton was threatening to bomb and then was going to bomb Iraq. And those of us who had been involved consistently in the anti-war movement throughout the Clinton administration, starting with our opposition to what was known as the Gulf War in 1991, we raised the issue of the sanctions, the genocidal sanctions, and really helped a lot of people to understand that sanctions were a form of war, just a different form of war, just as deadly as bombs being dropped. And we worked to educate people, the very well-meaning and well-intentioned people who rose up to oppose the bombing, but some of them said, but sanctions are okay. Sanctions, not war. Because they didn't understand what the sanctions really meant. And we met numerous people in the Arab American community who had family in Iraq, and they told us heartbreaking stories of their cousins who died because they had strep throat or an ear infection because they didn't have access to life-saving drugs that, like penicillin that we take for granted here. And they were dying because of a U.S. policy that was being supported by the Clinton administration that kept them from having clean water or medication to treat simple and easily treated illnesses.
Kevin Akin, we wouldn't really be talking about Bill Clinton's birthday, his 70th birthday, except for the fact that Hillary Clinton, who was then first lady during those 8 years when Bill Clinton was president, is, of course, running for president, is the preferred choice of Wall Street, is the preferred choice of the military-industrial complex, and thus will probably be the next president of the United States. So what happened with Bill Clinton's term and tenure is, in fact, very important and instructive because Hillary Clinton supported all of that. She supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2002. And a little earlier this year, Madeleine Albright, who was then U.S. ambassador, then Secretary of State, I think, where she was both U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. and Secretary of State under Clinton. She was asked by Leslie Stahl on national TV, hey, a 500,000 Iraqi kids died because of economic sanctions. They died. And as Jane said, I was there in Iraq, too, and I saw them dying in their mom's arms in the hospitals because they had diarrhea or other completely treatable problems that they couldn't get medicine for. But Madeleine Albright, when Leslie Stahl asked her, hey, 500,000 kids died. That's more than died in Hiroshima. Is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright said, hey, the price, that's a tough question, but yeah, the price is worth it. Now, Madeleine Albright said to women and to other progressive people, if you don't support Hillary Clinton, you're not supporting the empowerment of women in the political process. But this is the same team that sort of cavalierly took the lives of 1 million Iraqis, most of whom were children and their moms.
Was she the one who said that there's a special place in hell for women who don't support women? No matter how genocidal those women are, they won't support? Yes. Well, there may be special places reserved in hell for some of the people she's known, but I don't think it's for the folks who won't support genocide. The promises we got and what happened did differ in some ways. We had promises that the Clintons would seek peace, but what they meant was peace being the defeat of anyone who defied the U.S. government and its big corporations. They made promises on on labor. You know, there's quite a few people in the United States who died due to malnutrition, due to lack of medical care, and so on, as well as in Iraq. And we weren't the subject of an embargo. We were the subject of the day-to-day embargo of the poor that's enforced by the very wealthy in this country, by the ruling class. So there's a consistency there between domestic politics and foreign relations. The Democrats promised before the 1992 election, they promised, and some of my friends in labor, I was very active in my union at that time, still working, and they promised that the hiring of scabs to break strikes would be outlawed. This is something that Congress can outlaw. It's not unconstitutional. It can be done. They just won't do it because they're controlled by the big boys. And in 92, the election put not only Clinton in office, but during his term, there were some times when the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency, and they just didn't even try on that promised bill to outlaw using scabs to break strikes. They just discarded that. That was just to get our votes. And so many of the other things they said, and so many of the other things that Clinton is saying now, are just to get our votes. My vote's going to a socialist in November.
Okay. And just in 30 seconds, Kevin, I want you to just mention that. You just had a very successful convention of the Peace and Freedom Party. You nominated a presidential and vice presidential candidate, as well as taking up other business. In about 45 seconds, talk about that. And then I want to ask Jane Cutter the final question.
Sure. With a 70% vote on the first ballot, we nominated Gloria LaRiva for president. And with no opposition, we nominated Dennis Banks for vice president. So the ticket of Gloria LaRiva for president and Dennis Banks for vice president will be on the California ballot on the Peace and Freedom Party line. And I urge every Californian to vote for him.
Okay, Jane Cutter, you are going to have the last word. As Kevin mentioned, it's hard to separate domestic and foreign policy, especially in the United States, the world's greatest empire. There's 1,000 military bases around the world. But you had the Clinton administration also going to war against the people of Yugoslavia at the same time as he was cutting off aid for dependent children. Talk about that, if you would. We have about a minute and 20 seconds left.
Well, certainly the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia was a tremendous crime. A tremendous war crime, the use of depleted uranium bombs, extremely devastating. And then, yes, the so-called end to welfare, as we know it, also known as the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, was predicted to throw 1 million children into poverty. And Clinton, this was considered a highlight of his, a great success, a great accomplishment of Bill Clinton's, was that he threw women off of AFDC and required them to work, set strict limits on how many years you could receive this kind of support.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's Jane Cutter. We've been talking to Jane Cutter, editor of liberationnews.org, and Kevin Aiken, the state chairperson of Peace and Freedom Party. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Protesters filled the streets of Belgrade as Vice President Joseph Biden visited Serbia this week. Belgrade was the city Biden was a leading advocate of bombing in 1999. But Serbia's new prime minister has called him a personal friend. Is that country now in the arms of Washington? We are joined by Christopher Black. He is an international human rights attorney based in Toronto, Canada, and a counsel to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Welcome back, Christopher.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
On Friday, activists will put up a monument in Novi Sad, Serbia, to commemorate the victims of what they call NATO's bombardment and other victims at the hands of the international community. Tell us about what happened at Novi Sad.
Well, like all of Serbia, the NATO forces conducted intense bombing raids on infrastructure, chemical plants, facilities, water plants, bridges, and so on. And Novi Sad was particularly hard hit. The bombing lasted 3 months, and you can still see damage today in some parts of those cities, especially in Belgrade. The commemoration of the bombing of Novi Sad, where there was heavy destruction of industrial plants and chemical plants, I believe, which caused a lot of environmental destruction as well, is one of the great war crimes of the 20th century and is equal to anything that that happened in World War II, in my opinion.
Right. So we had between March 24th, 1999 and June 3rd, 1999, 28,000 bombs and missiles were dropped by NATO on that very small country, Serbia and Kosovo, which was, of course, was at that time part of Serbia, had been part of Serbia for hundreds of years. It was part of the breakup, really, of a multi-ethnic, multinational republic, the Republic of Yugoslavia. You were part of the International Criminal Tribunal proceedings. You were an opponent of those proceedings. You were defending some of the people like Slobodan Milosevic, who had been the leader of Yugoslavia, who was brought to The Hague, was put on trial, died there in 2006. But recently, in the case of Radovan Karadzic, who was convicted of war crimes as the Serbian president, Milosevic was exonerated. I mean, that was like a sudden, surprising turn of events. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of discussion about that judgment raised by Andy Wilcoxon, who's been following these trials for quite some time. It was very valuable that he brought that to our attention because the Western media did not. But my take on it is a bit different than other people's. It's true that the court, in order to convict Karadzic in his trial, downplayed the role of Milosevic and pumped up the role of Karadzic in comparison. And so they made some positive remarks about Milosevic's role in the creation of the Srpska Republic and whether it should have been created, how it should have been set up, and so on. And they used the disagreements between Karadzic and Milosevic to make Karadzic look bad. But in doing that, they did say some positive things about Milosevic, which were contrary to the indictment against Milosevic during his trial. So in some sense, exoneration in a way, but you have to remember that the judges had no intention of exonerating Milosevic by saying these things. Their whole purpose was geared to convicting Karadzic of false charges. And it strikes me as a macabre joke that we are now relying on statements by the same judges who ended up killing Milosevic and then say that they now exonerate him. Because in my opinion, he was never convicted of anything. He proved during his trial that all the charges against him were false in the first place. And he was never convicted because he was killed before he died in jail before the trial ended and could establish his innocence completely. So I'm not so happy about that decision or the reliance on Karadzic's judgment to say that Milosevic was exonerated when they, in fact, killed him.
Yeah, no, I understand. That's an excellent point of clarification. Christopher Black, you are an international human rights attorney. Let's talk about that tribunal, that court, so-called, that is holding Milosevic and the others for trial, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, ICTY. I mean, talk about that. How is it that a court is created just for a particular set of circumstances? Who pays for that court? And why is it that the NATO bombers who dropped 28,000 bombs, as the British defense minister called it when he was asked at a media, I remember him saying, well, these were democratic bombers. I mean, you could just ask the people on the ground, I was glad I was bombed by a democratic bomb. But anyway, talk about the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It's not a court, it's a kangaroo court, isn't it?
Right. The UN has no right to set up such these ad hoc tribunals, the ICTY or the Rwanda Tribunal, the Sierra Leone, all these things. They're all that the UN Charter does not provide any provision for such a thing. It's outside their jurisdiction to create it, so it's illegally created. I was told by a Russian deputy foreign minister a couple of years ago when we met with them about these tribunals that they were allowed to be set up by the Russians and Chinese, especially Russia at that time, because Yeltsin was in power, and they said Yeltsin was one of the American assets, so it allowed anything to go. And as soon as the ICTY was set up, it was immediately taken over by U.S. military and CIA intelligence people and NATO people, Canadians, British, and so on, Dutch, Germans, who are mainly the staff there. The funding, it's funded out of a general fund from the UN, but there's also a separate private fund, more or less, where private corporations can donate funds to the corporate, to the ICTY, including General Electric, Westinghouse, DuPont, and so on, various NGOs, think tanks in the States, or as many of them, I can't, off the top of my head, can't think of the names now, but they're very famous, like the Carnegie Institute, for instance, their endowment, they supplied money. So it's a very strange thing. It's privately funded by NATO, basically, to conduct trials against the victims of NATO attacks. And Luis Arbor, who was the prosecutor at the time that Milosevic was indicted, from the instructions of Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright, said openly in a press conference that the ICTY uses NATO as their police force, and that therefore the ICTY is an arm of NATO. And so the whole purpose of the ICTY, in my mind, is threefold. It's to demonize the former government of Yugoslavia, legitimate government, and make it look like they're a bunch of criminals. It's to justify the attack on Yugoslavia by presenting a false history of events during that time to justify the attack, which is all false propaganda. And thirdly, it covers up the role of NATO and their crimes when they attacked Yugoslavia. So there's the indictments, when you read them, are not actually indictments you'd see in a normal criminal court. They're really propaganda tracks going on for dozens of pages. And they're nothing more than drafted in order to be issued for press releases and put out in the press. They're not really indictments. So the kangaroo court says show trials, and to discuss whether somebody's acquitted or convicted is, to me, irrelevant. Either an acquittal or a conviction in these tribunals, every one of them is politically a political decision. They decide to let some people go and some people are convicted, and they have their reasons for doing so. There's nothing to do with justice.
That's the international human rights attorney, Christopher Black. We're talking to Christopher Black from Toronto, where he has a law practice. He's talking about the ICTY. That's the International Criminal Tribunal, in this case for the former Yugoslavia, set up by the United Nations, by the Security Council, privately funded in some part by corporations and by the NATO entities themselves that went to war against Yugoslavia. Christopher Black, you know, there's an election coming up in 2016, November, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. Bill Clinton was the president back in 1999 and throughout the 1990s. They're celebrating Bill Clinton's birthday this week. When you, as a participant, as a defender of those who had been brought to this kangaroo court, paid for by corporations, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, when you think about Bill Clinton, what do you think about? Milosevic came and was, you said, killed there at The Hague or died there, but there was no accountability at all for those like Bill Clinton who ordered the bombing of this republic, this nation, this country that was, in fact, at peace with the United States.
No, and that shows exactly, it proves the fact that these tribunals are just assets of the U.S. government, basically, and its NATO allies. Bill Clinton was responsible for this aggression against a European state, the last socialist state in Europe. Massive destruction was caused. Thousands of people were killed and tens of thousands wounded. Yugoslavia disappeared. One of the founding members of the Non-Aligned Movement was just crushed. And now Serbia is just a puppet state. It's just a shell of what it used to be. Now, one illustration of how evil these people are is that when the Yugoslav government decided to basically surrender in June of 1999 because they were doing quite well. They were actually fending off the NATO attacks. I mean, they were, hadn't been defeated militarily. But what killed it was a visit paid to Belgrade by Mr. Ahtisaari, who's the Finnish man who won the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, and Chernomyrdin, who was the Yeltsin's ambassador from Russia, came to give Milosevic a diktat, a message from the United States. And the message was that unless you surrender, the Americans intend to carpet bomb Belgrade. And Chernomyrdin told Milosevic, several people at that meeting, that if you do not, within 2 weeks, we're going to flatten Belgrade and we're going to kill 500,000 people. And it was that which led Milosevic to go to his parliament and say, this is what we face. Do you want to carry on fighting or do you want to give up? They decided not to kill any more people. They gave up. That's how evil these people are. So Bill Clinton is one of the most evil people on the planet, and his wife knew all about that, I'm sure. So what else can you say? I mean, it's just disgusting what's going on. We have the choice in the United States of a clown like Trump or a criminal like the Clintons.
Yeah. When I was going back to and thinking about this, of course, Christopher, as you know, I was very involved in helping to lead demonstrations that were taking place in the United States. Tens of thousands of people. We were demonstrating almost every day and night. The mass media refused to cover the demonstration. One time, the New York Times said, and the New York Times refused to have a demonstration. So we called the demonstration at the New York Times. 5,000 people came out and threw eggs at the New York Times building. And the next day, we finally got our first article. So now we know how you get media attention from the mainstream media. You just bring 5,000 eggs or something. But it was just such a setup. I mean, Yugoslavia was completely demonized. The media was completely for it. The Social Democratic and Liberal parties, not the right-wing parties, were the agency for the NATO bombing. Most of the parties were not right-wing Republican or Christian Democrats. They were Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. And then you have a situation where after the destruction of Yugoslavia, it's out of the news. So what is life like now for the now newly freed Yugoslavia, broken up, of course, into different sort of mini states? What's the situation for the people there?
Well, as far as I can tell from my contacts in the Balkans, life hasn't improved at all. I mean, they've lost most of their social services, which they used to have under the socialist state in all the republics. In Serbia in particular, they bombed deliberately private industrial plants, which are now being taken over. Like they bombed the Zastava car plant, which produced automobiles in Yugoslavia, now was destroyed. They hit that several times in order to wipe it out. And now they've been bought out by Peugeot. So now Serbs can't buy their own cars. They have to buy German and French models. So it's just gangsterism. It's like Al Capone. They're going to not only destroy this Yugoslavia as a state, but they destroyed its economic competition. They're just gangsters. So wages are no better than they were then, but they've lost all the social services. People are depressed. There's no sense of national pride. You have people like when Biden was there, I understand when a military at the airport or the there's a welcoming ceremony in the military union walked past with the Serbian flag. He refused to, he avoided saluting it, so insulted them. He called it Croatia in a speech instead of Serbia. And Mr. Sessel, the Radical Party, organized a protest, but it was a protest where he called for the support, vote for Trump. I mean, it's just stupid. So there was the movement of Serbia did have a small protest asking for NATO to get the jackboot off their Serbian necks. But it's just pathetic what's going on because the government they have in Belgrade now and all the puppet, they're all puppet vassal regimes put in place by the Americans and the Germans and the British. And Joe Biden's going to spend 2 days in Kosovo, only 6 hours in Serbia. And by the way, I understand that they're going to name one of the roads leading into Camp Bondsteel, a big American base there, maybe the biggest in the world. They're going to name it after Joe Biden's son. And I have a quote today that he told Hashim Thaçi, who's the president of Kosovo, so-called Kosovo, that he wants him to sign an agreement with Montenegro. I mean, he's just giving diktats to this war criminal. Because Hashim Thaçi was famous for coming to Toronto back in the 90s and showing videos to the Toronto Star of how he cut the heads off Serbs himself personally with a knife. this is the president, he should be in jail. So, I mean, so you see that they're treating Serbia as just as if it's with complete contempt. And there seems that the spirit in the Serbian people is being totally crushed, except for a few small pockets of patriotic resistance.
So that was Christopher Black, international human rights attorney. He had been at the International Criminal Tribunal in Yugoslavia defending those like Slobodan Milosevic who had been brought to the trial. We're talking about what's happened to Yugoslavia after the 1990 war, how it, too, is a fragmented country, like Iraq became fragmented, like Libya was fragmented after the NATO bombing. We'll come back, and Christopher Black, we hope you will join us again to discuss this and other issues. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.